have an information hearing, and substance abuse treatment is the topic. And we'll start with that. We're going to have a little bit later a... Well, goodness gracious. Okay. Well, we have a couple of committee bills that we're going to introduce, at least discuss and hopefully introduce. The committee hasn't had a chance to decide yet. This is the last day for bill introduction, so we're going to entertain a couple of committee bills, and then we're going to hear Senate Bill 357 and Senate Bill 491. These will be public hearings and possible work sessions. So we will start with the invited testimony, Anthony Biglin. Would you come up, please? Dennis McCarthy and Eric Martin. Okay, the cast of players is changing.
They want us to introduce them, okay. So just like, we're just going to talk for about 10 seconds each.
Okay.
I'm Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. And
I'm Lisa Nato, Multnomah County Commissioner.
Okay. Thank you.
I chair the Association of Oregon County's Human Services Steering Committee. Lisa chairs the Public Safety Committee. We have been teaming up together on a comprehensive strategy, and in front of you, you should have a packet that includes the activities that we were working on today. It says Addictions Treatment Works at the top. There are some flyers underneath that have some important information, much of what was put together by Mr. Martin. We are trying to lay the foundation today that treatment does work, and that resources that go to counties and communities for these programs are essential in Oregon. So we brought to talk to you today three experts from Oregon Health Sciences University, from Oregon Research Institute, and Eric Martin, who's with the Accreditation Council and also teaches at University of Oregon, and they're going to share their wisdom with you. So we appreciate your time and attention.
Good. Thank you.
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, I'm Dennis McCarthy. I'm a professor of public health and preventive medicine at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm the principal investigator for the Oregon-Hawaii node of the National Drug Abuse Treatment Clinical Trials Network. I work at the intersection of policy, practice, and research, and I've learned that drug abuse treatment programs are often challenged. They have limited resources, unlimited demand, and insufficient resources. But the programs I've worked with have learned to turn those challenges into opportunities. And today I'd like to speak briefly about the opportunity they have to strengthen their services and to improve those services for all of Oregon. I'm going to do that by talking about why they can improve, how they can improve, and do those improvements work. I've actually edited my slide set down. You have a bigger set of slides there in front of you. And I'm going to use a conversation I had on an airplane recently to help illustrate and provide examples for the testimony. I was flying to Washington, D.C. for a grant meeting. It was late. I didn't want to be in the air. I was in the middle seat in the bulkhead row. Mr. Everyman sat down next to me at the window, and as we took off from Atlanta, he said, tell me, what do you do? I can usually inhibit those conversations by saying, I study the organization and financing of treatment for alcohol and drug disorders. He didn't want to inhibit. He wanted to talk. He said, well, I know exactly what to do. He said, treatment doesn't work. We need to put them all on an island and let them take care of themselves. Well, I've heard that before, and I understand that it's code words for leave them alone, they'll die off, we don't have to worry about them. So I decided to engage and use this as a teachable moment and began to talk about the nature of drug and alcohol treatment. And one of the things you hear is that treatment doesn't work, and the reality is quite the converse, that we have good outcomes. 40 to 60% are abstinent at 12 months. The converse means that 40 to 60% could be improved. those outcomes are comparable to the outcomes found in healthcare for other chronic diseases. Diabetes, there's only about 60% compliance with the diet, with the medication, with the exercise that's required. Same is true for hypertension and asthma, only about 40% adherence to the behavioral changes that individuals with those chronic diseases can do that will improve their health outcome. So I think drug and alcohol treatment is as good as other forms of treatment for chronic disease. There are, in fact, treatments that are effective, that are available. This is a review of the literature. It identifies several of the most effective treatments. These are the first eight. The environment where drug and alcohol treatment programs work is changing rapidly. There's an expectation for accountability, not just for drug and alcohol treatment, but for all of healthcare. The Institute of Medicine has used its Crossing the Quality Chasm to help make that call. Care must be safe, effective, patient-centered, timely, effective, and equitable. And all healthcare, and more specifically, treatment for alcohol, drug, and mental health disorders, is going to be expected to comply and just demonstrate their capability to provide care that meets those dimensions. These programs have tremendous opportunities. By making improvements, they can reduce their inefficiencies, they can improve their bottom line, they can develop new markets, and they can improve patient outcomes. And they're going to do that by implementing evidence-based treatments, by developing new linkages and alliances with primary care, with mental health services, with the criminal justice and the child welfare systems. And they'll be developing new technologies that make those treatments effective and available to more individuals. It's important to recognize that change is not self-executing. Implementation requires purposeful activity and attention to who are the staff, what's their training, what's their supervision, and that there must be administrative support and systems in places to make those services effective. And that's one place where treatment programs need more support. They need more infrastructure. Staff turnover rates range up to 25% per year. You can't do effective services if you're not retaining staff effectively. I also work with a program called the Network for the Improvement of Addictions Treatment. This is sponsored by the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment and by the Robert Wood Johnson's Foundation. It's teaching treatment programs to implement, to use process improvement to reduce the time it takes to get into care and to improve retention and care. And I've got one example here from a program in Maine. It's a rural hospital. They've been able to increase the number of admissions they serve by four times. They've been able to turn around a $200,000 a year deficit to a $200,000 a year surplus. They've gone from a wait to treatment for 4 days to 1 day, and they've improved the retention, the completion rate, from about 20% to over 68%. All programs can use these techniques to make these kinds of changes, and it not only makes good clinical sense, it makes good business sense. So it improves the system as well as patient outcomes. These are the results across all of the programs participating in the program. Days to treatment were reduced by nearly 40%. Retention and care increased by nearly 20%, 18%. Got a second session that didn't get it previously. 17% more got a third session that didn't get it previously. Niatex is coming to Oregon. There's an opportunity for 50 outpatient treatment programs in Oregon to participate. And it's important for us to keep our mind on persistent improvements in quality and effectiveness of care. Let me bring you back to the airplane. As we landed at National Airport, I wrapped up my conversation, and Mr. Quiet Man sitting on the aisle seat turned to me and he said, "Thank you. I enjoyed your conversation." He went on to disclose that he'd been in recovery from heroin use for 12 years. I thanked him. I said, "That's hard work." And more to himself than me, he said, "Yes, yes it is. Many of my friends never made it. Those people he knew using heroin were still using heroin or had died from the consequences of their heroin use. And for me, that's why we're working to improve quality. We want to help those people who haven't made it make it." Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. Questions?
the swapping out equipment here. We'll be right with you. There it is. It's a slow system.
Good afternoon. My name is Eric Martin, and I'm Executive Director of the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon. I'm also an instructor with the University of Oregon and the State Child Welfare System. I'm also on the Governor's Advisory Board on Drugs and Violent Crime. And I'm also a recovering person. I was formerly addicted to crack cocaine and went to addiction treatment in 1983. And I've been in recovery ever since and working in the treatment field for the last 21 years. Oregon has, I was invited to speak a little bit about treatment in regards to what addiction treatment counselors work with on a regular basis, the challenges in cognitive impairments and the growing number of cognitive impairments that they see in addiction treatment clients. Alcohol and drug abuse has reached epidemic proportions among Oregon's young people. If you look at this graph, this is from Oregon Healthy Teens 2001 through 2006 and Monitoring the Future 2001 to 2006. The gray bars that you see there represent the national average for past 30-day alcohol use and past 30-day drug use among eighth graders. The red bars represent the Oregon average for past 30-day alcohol use and past 30-day drug use. You also have a little handout that shows you the same thing. Since 9/11, largely alcohol and drug abuse has gone down among young people nationwide. Oregon is one of a handful of states where we've actually seen an increase in alcohol and drug abuse among young people. Currently, Oregon eighth graders drink 86% higher than the national average and use illegal drugs at about twice the national average. So you might be saying, well, Eric, what does this have to do with cognition among alcohol and drug clients coming into treatment? Well, there is a growing body of research that suggests that when kids start using alcohol and drugs at a very young age, that it may impact the development of the brain. We used to think that the brain was fully developed around the age of 13. Now we know that the brain is still growing and developing all the way up until the age of 24, that myelination is occurring in the frontal lobes of the brain and that new connections are being formed. So this new information and new research that's coming along is really highlighting the dangers of early onset substance abuse. And that's really what I'm here to tell you, is that one of the things that we've noticed here in Oregon that has been noticed nationwide and noticed in research in recent years is that most of the most troublesome alcoholics and addicts that end up in services, that end up in the criminal justice system, that end up in addiction treatment services, that end up as co-occurring disorder patients in mental health systems have this one unique factor in common. And that it is that they started drinking or using drugs between the ages of 8 and 15 years old. New research that has come out from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, now tells us that 95% of U.S. adult alcoholics and alcohol abusers started drinking before the age of 21. They've done a significant amount of research just in the last 7 years looking at heavy alcohol-using youth compared to kids that never drink, or kids that drink rarely, or kids that drink a little more often, all the way up to the heaviest using adolescents. Heavy using 12 to 17 year olds are twice as likely to participate in violence than kids who don't drink. They are four times as likely to seriously attack others than kids who don't drink. They're 12 times more likely to steal than kids who don't drink. They're 34 times more likely to sell drugs than kids who don't drink. They're 5 times more likely to carry a handgun than kids who don't drink. Research on more than 42,000 kids now tells us that every year that alcohol consumption is postponed significantly reduces the probability of someone ever becoming an alcoholic. So you're going to hear a little bit more with our next speaker in regards to some of the dangers of early onset substance abuse. And that is something that we deal with on a daily basis in addiction treatment services, because most of the folks that we get started drinking and using drugs at a very young age. Now to tell you a little bit about sort of the state of treatment in Oregon. Oregon ranks 7th nationally for recent illicit drug use in people 12 and older. We rank 2nd in the U.S. for illicit drug use among adults 26 and up. We rank 4th in the U.S. for drug abuse and dependence among 18 to 25-year-olds. And a recent statistic that just recently came out from the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration now ranks Oregon as 3rd for non-medical use of prescription drugs among 12 to 17-year-olds, 3rd in the nation. Oregon simultaneously ranks 45th in the U.S. for treatment access. And we rank 49th in the U.S. for treatment access among 18 to 25-year-olds. Early onset substance abuse probably has an impact on the brain, and we're going to hear more about that in the future as more and more research comes out. But one of the things that we know has had a dramatic effect on the brain here in Oregon is methamphetamine. Research by Dr. Nora Volkov at the National Institute on Drug Abuse showed that in a study that she did over a period of 3 years following meth addicts, she found that there was an 8% atrophy rate, tissue loss, in the hippocampus of the brain. Whoops, sorry about that. Which is right here. And the hippocampus is largely responsible for attention and memory. She also found an 11% atrophy rate right here in the limbic section of the brain, which is largely responsible for emotional regulation. Methamphetamine takes its toll. It takes its toll.
Say that again. The hippocampus
is largely responsible for attention and memory.
Okay. Thank you.
So when addicts come into treatment, they have a significant amount of cognitive impairments. They have difficulty making inferences, difficulty manipulating and synthesizing information, difficulty understanding metaphor, demonstrating insight, learning from experience, and ignoring irrelevant information. And these have all been well documented in research. These severe cognitive impairments last for about 90 days. So here's part of the problem. In business as usual, okay, just simply locking people up and putting them on a strict regimen in regards to probation, we're expecting people to sort of spin around on a dime and all of a sudden become highly responsible and functional people. Research tells us that that's not going to happen for a while after a person quits drinking or using drugs because of the significant level of cognitive impairments that they have. Treatment providers around the state of Oregon have been getting better at working with folks with this sort of brain injury, and we need to get even better. And we're working with researchers like Dennis to get better at what it is that we do. Research also tells us that memory is significantly impaired for about a year after a person quits drinking and using drugs, especially with drugs like methamphetamine. We also found that memory actually gets worse after a person gets sober. Now, this is counterintuitive to what most people think. Most people think, well, the day you quit doing drugs, you're supposed to be all better. You're all better now because you quit doing drugs. And what we found is that people actually get worse. They actually get worse in their ability to perform. Their memory actually gets worse. In research done by numerous researchers around the U.S., including Dr. Rawson down at the Matrix Institute, one of our nation's leading methamphetamine researchers, he found that memory actually gets worse for 6 months. And we need to put in place little systems, and this is what we're working on in addiction treatment services, little systems like calling and reminding people about their appointments, calling them and reminding them about treatment appointments and court appointments and probation appointments. We don't really have a good system for doing that. We know that upwards of 90% of criminal offenders are substance abusers. We know that they are probably encountering severe memory impairments, but we don't have good systems for working with their cognitive impairments. The funny thing is that most of our dentists and doctors call us. They call us all the time to remind us about our appointments, but we don't have a system to remind people that we know have cognitive impairments about their appointments. So we're working harder to get better. And we've got good numbers here in Oregon. For example, nationwide, the average completion rate for treatment is 50.1%. Here in Oregon, we're at almost 60%. So we do a good job here in Oregon. I assume all of you have a copy of the green form, the treatment effectiveness brochure. That one, the green one. If you open to the first inside page there, on the first inside page, you'll see a picture of a mom there. And the good news here in Oregon, in regards to the effectiveness of treatment in Oregon, is that over 49% of moms whose children have been removed by the state that get into treatment, get into recovery, and get reunited with their kids. Now, some people may say, well, that doesn't sound too good. 49.3%, that's not most of them. That's a huge amount. To get half of moms reunited with their kids saves the state buckets of money, because that kid is no longer in foster care, and the mom is now taking care of the kids. And if mom has any kids in the future, it decreases the probability that she will end up in the child welfare system again, facing yet another termination case. It saves on court costs. It reduces public assistance. I was at a DA's conference over in Seaside, and I got into a discussion with one of the DAs in a class that I was teaching over there in regards to treatment and methamphetamine. And the DA said, well, you know, once I terminate the parental rights, you know, who cares what happens to mom after that? She can go off using meth and die for all I care, because I've already terminated the parental rights. It's over. And I said, well, you know, that's not usually what we see. We see that mom goes off and we'll have another kid and we'll be involved in DHS and child welfare again another couple years down the road. So even in cases where parental rights are terminated, it's still sound financial wisdom to still get mom into recovery, to still prevent that from ever happening again. It takes time for folks to get better. This is one brain scan of a 24-year-old young man in the state of Hawaii, and they did a glucose metabolism scan of his brain, which basically looks at brain activity levels. At the top there is a frontal view of the brain, and that's a normal control. And this is that young man, 24 years old, at 4 months clean and sober off of methamphetamine. And that's the bottom two pictures. He has many areas of the brain with low activity. It takes time for folks to get better. Researchers generally estimate that it takes about a year. It takes about a year when a person quits chronic use of alcohol and drugs for their brain to start operating on all cylinders again. This is one guy with years of alcohol, cocaine, and methamphetamine use. He was admitted to the Almond Clinic down in California, and then they scanned his brain when he got 1 year clean and sober, and he looked significantly better. Giving a helping hand and reaching out to addicts and helping them get into recovery provides significant benefit to society in reuniting the parents with their kids, saving the cost of foster care, of court cost, and by producing taxpayers that participate in society and participate in our system. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Montes Anderson.
Having worked with people who abuse, what does the research show us regarding, I know those pictures show that the brain is healing. I mean, they're finding out that even though parts of the brain can be damaged, that there is healing. Is that correct? I mean, I keep looking at some of these people and I say, if you just keep clean, your brain's going to get better. You're going to start remembering things more. You're going to be able to start getting up with this at the right time every morning and maybe even getting a job. But can you tell some success stories there then?
Well, that's true. I mean, you're really talking about three major mechanisms of action that occur in the brain when a person has chronic abuse of alcohol and drugs. And first and foremost is an imbalance of brain chemicals. Brain chemicals become imbalanced. Some can be overactive, some can be underactive. Then you have a phenomenon called downregulation, where receptor sites basically grow shut and then have to grow back open again. And then lastly, you have actual damage to brain cells where brain cells die. And the general rule of thumb in neurology is, you know, once you kill a brain cell, it's gone forever. It never grows back. So there would be some instances where some people may never recover from certain cognitive impairments that incurred. But much of it is going to come back as a result of upregulation of receptor sites and brain chemistry being restored and renewed.
Thank you.
But it does take time.
Thank you. Oh, yes, Senator Virgil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You gave us some very depressing statistics. Why Oregon? Why do we have more drug use? Is it the accessibility of drugs? Is it a breakdown in family? Is it lifestyle? And then also, have you studied the states in where the drug use is far lower?
It's a very complicated question. And I think you could probably respond to that a little bit more in your presentation, because you're really talking about prevention at this point. But I can tell you this, that in my 21 years of experience as an instructor, a research dissemination specialist, and a treatment provider, that it's usually all of the above. There isn't any one answer as to why a particular state has high rates of substance abuse. There's usually a dozen particular reasons. And one of the reasons that we're really taking a look at this session is the fact that early onset substance abuse, like on alcohol and tobacco, are inextricably linked to later illicit substance abuse. There's a significant body of research that tells us that early onset alcohol and tobacco linked to later illicit drug abuse. So I think at this point, he could probably respond to that question a little bit better than I.
Thank you. Okay, let's go ahead. Did you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Okay. Introduce yourself, please.
My name is Tony Biglin, and I'm a senior scientist at Oregon Research Institute and the director of the Center of Early Adolescence. I'm also the president of the Society for Prevention Research, which is an international organization that was formed about 15 years ago that's brought together prevention researchers. It was formed because there's been so much research showing that there are effective preventive interventions. I have a slide on a talk I'm going to give tomorrow that would directly answer your question, and I think a quick answer would be that certainly the key factors that have been shown to make a difference are family, peer, and school, and to a lesser extent, neighborhoods and communities. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the ways in which those factors are important and how we can, taking advantage of that knowledge, prevent many of the kinds of problems we've talked about. So I want to talk about some of the problems
now,
of youth.
I'm sorry, Tony. Before you get started, we're kind of running short on time here. And so 5 or 10 minutes at the latest. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Problems, cost, preventive interventions, and the cost-benefit of prevention. These are some of the problems. The first important thing to realize here is that these problems are interrelated. The same kids that have one of these problems are significantly more likely to have other of these problems. And so in order to prevent any of these problems, we need to understand the factors that produce the whole range of problems and to develop interventions that make a difference. We did a study at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences a couple years ago where we looked at the cost of these problems and found that nationally, in 1 year, the cost of these problems is $419 billion, is our best estimate. If you prorate the population of Oregon, our estimate is that it costs about $5 billion a year for all of these different kinds of problem behavior. So if we can prevent these problems, we can have an enormous benefit in the state. This is a summary of the kinds of things that have been shown to have an impact. From the prenatal period through early childhood, middle childhood, on through adolescence, there are interventions that can prevent the development of these kinds of problems. There are family interventions, peer-focused, school-focused, media, and community interventions. I'm going to take you through just to give you a few examples. The nurse visitation program developed by David Olds works, has nurses visit mothers who are poor and at risk to have problems. They start visiting them during pregnancy. They work with them on issues like prenatal care, maternal smoking, which is a big risk factor, mothering skills, contraception, and work life. That program, in the first study that was done, they followed kids and families for 15 years, and they found that the kids in those that got the program were significantly less likely to be abused and neglected. The mothers were more likely to work. The kids were less likely to engage in delinquent behavior as adolescents. This is the statistics done by the RAND Corporation showing that the total savings per family that received this program were about $30,000, more than $30,000. Another program is the Good Behavior Game. This is a simple program that has classroom teens in elementary school just earn small rewards for being on task and being cooperative. There have been about 50 studies showing the value of the game, and this is an example of the kinds of outcomes. This is one recent study that showed that by eighth grade, kids that had the Good Behavior Game had significantly less marijuana use than kids in the control. And this is with a program that they only got in the first grade, and they see benefits like this. One study showed that there were significantly less arrests in middle school among kids who got this program just in the first grade. In middle school, a whole bunch of new risk factors come in. There's lower self-esteem, there's increased depression, there's formation of deviant peer groups, and there's initiation of substance use and delinquency. One of the reasons that early adolescence is so difficult is because the teen brain is different from both children's brains and adults' brains. So there are other reasons for creating nurturing environments. This is an example of the degree to which a young adult's brain becomes active when they are rewarded versus an adolescent's brain. And the point here is that in order to have an impact on adolescence, we need to be richly rewarding of the kind of positive behavior we want, because it takes more to reach and affect them than it does for younger kids or for adults. Another brain change is that the levels of serotonin drop during adolescence, and that is associated with increased irritability, aggression, and depression. If you've raised adolescents, you may have experienced this for yourself. I know I did. One of the things that has been developed is school-wide positive behavior support. This is a program developed in Oregon, and incidentally, one of the largest cottage factory industries in Oregon is behavioral science research, and many of the things that I'm describing were developed in Oregon. So ironically, they're being used around the country, but much less in Oregon. Positive behavior support increases the degree of teaching of pro-social behavior and rewards for appropriate social behavior. This is an example of what happened in one school in Lane County when we introduced positive behavior support. The discipline referrals dropped dramatically. This has been shown in literally hundreds of schools around the country. Another important one, which I think gets to Senator Verger's question, is the effectiveness of behavioral parenting interventions. There are studies that show that behavioral parenting interventions that teach parents the skills to be involved with their kids, to be reinforcing with their kids, to monitor and set limits, produce benefits from early childhood through adolescence. And one of the programs developed and tested here in Oregon is called the Family Checkup, developed at the Child and Family Center at the University of Oregon. And they found that simply offering parents a checkup where they could come in and get information about their parenting and see how they're doing with respect to limit setting and monitoring and so on produced significant benefits. For example, it reduced, this is a program that went in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and by 11th grade, 2 years, 3 years after the program had been done, the kids who didn't get it were using marijuana at this level, and the kids who did get it were using it at this level. So it had a significant benefit in reducing marijuana. It also had a significant benefit in reducing arrests. This is the arrests of kids who didn't get the program. This is the arrests of kids who did. And by the way, this is all done with randomized control trials in which you can safely conclude that it was the program that caused these benefits.
Now, is this, Mr. Chair, this program is, what did you call it again? It's
a family checkup.
Family.
Yeah, it was, and that this comes from a study that was done in Portland in a set of middle schools. But there are several other related studies. There's very clear evidence that parenting interventions with middle schoolers can prevent substance use and delinquency. Now, I just learned today that one of those programs is in the governor's budget, and that's the Strengthening Families program that was developed by Dick Spoth at the Iowa State University. It's a 7-week program where they work with both the parents and the kids. And I just want to show you the cost effectiveness of this. Of 100 kids, they estimate that about 5.5 would not become alcohol abusers as a result of this program. So for about $12,400 per prevented alcohol case of alcoholism. And if you go to the cost-benefit ratio, the best estimate is that preventing that would prevent about $119,000 in costs, medical care costs and other costs, criminal costs. And so the cost effectiveness for every dollar you put in to this program, you get about a $9.60 return on your investment. Here are three other programs that are treatment programs for adolescents that have been shown to have benefits. This is a study done by the Washington State Public Policy Institute, which was asked by the Washington legislature to examine the effectiveness of crime prevention mechanisms. The best program, the multidimensional treatment foster care, the benefit per participant was $77,000. This is the estimate they came up with. This is a program, by the way, that was developed in Oregon. I'm not sure how I'm doing on time.
We're almost out.
Okay, so I will mention that there are also effective preventive interventions involving policy. If you increase the price of cigarettes, it's well established that you can decrease the number of kids who start smoking. And there are numerous studies showing that. And this is a study from the American Journal of Public Health. This is in my handout showing the benefit of this. But I would also mention that similarly, increases in the price of beer have been shown to decrease drinking among minors, to decrease binge drinking. They actually have a greater impact on heavy drinking than they do on the drinking of other teens, and they've actually been shown to decrease motor vehicle fatalities among teens. So raising the price of beer has a direct preventive effect, whatever you do with the money. And I think that in light of the time, I will stop talking.
Just a point regarding the cigarette tax. I know that there has now been an increased use. We have cut our tobacco prevention program big time and recently and haven't kept up to standard. And it's my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, that we have an increase in smoking, especially among girls in middle, high, and high school.
This is actually a study that we did in conjunction with the state. And if you look here at 11th grade, this shows that the schools funded by the TPEP program had significantly lower prevalence of smoking in 11th grade than did the unfunded schools. And there's another study we're in the process of doing that shows that when schools lost funding, the smoking level went up.
It does. It's...
Well, and drinking among 8th grade girls has increased significantly.
Yes.
I saw a study on that, too. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, George.
I hope my voice will hold out. It appears to me that when we took out Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet, we made a big mistake as a culture. And I would ask each one of you in this room today, when you go home today, tonight, I want you to pick up your, use your computer, use your phone, your pen, whatever, and notify the folks that to do the movies, to do the music, and all the rest of this, that to stop encouraging our children towards bad behavior. And if you want to do anything, I want you to deal with 4 million children being given psychotropic drugs in public schools every day. What message do you send? In a state that has a pro-marijuana culture, what do you expect? Our children have been taught that if you drink coffee and you smoke cigarettes, it's the same as this person doing cocaine. You can't relate those two. You send a very bad message. We just left a hearing on dealing with workers' comp. And you know what? You need to prevent the injury. That's your best way to handle it.
Right.
Not to treat the injured person, prevent the injury.
Right.
And part of that is changing the culture, the attitude between the employees and the employers about accidents. So, I mean, this is all great, but this is chasing the horses because you left the gate open. So until you address the social issues, the liberal attitude that family is bad has resulted in this. I would have told you this in 1955, that this is where we would end up because of the attitude towards the family. So I guess there's no question in there.
Oh, I have an answer.
Okay. Are you going to write your letter?
Well, I would simply say that you're right, that it's one of the vital things here is to make sure that families are doing the kinds of things that appeared to happen on the shows that you referred to. And these are programs that schools and churches can and are implementing that are doing exactly that. And so they're producing the kind of careful parental monitoring and supervision that you're talking about.
Who's going to do that, though? Are the parents going to come forward and ask to participate, or are we going to intervene? Because I looked at some of the stuff, and some of these intervening programs I objected to a few years ago when the governor had that childhood program. And we were talking about, let me give you an example of how this thing goes. Here in Marion County, a person who used to work for me went in to deliver her child, and she had not been through their prenatal care. And she was interrogated following the delivery of the baby that night as to, tell me, dear, what is your education level? And her answer was, a degree in law from University of Oregon. Who are you? Was her response. Now, this was not a friendly approach. What can we do?
Right.
I mean, literally, the decision they'd made was because they feared government involvement. They wanted to protect their family from the kind of things. Tell me how you're going to do this on a voluntary basis.
Well, I think the family resource centers that I described are just that. I've been working with Kate Cavanaugh, who's developed these, and the program I talked about with the family checkup. And you'd be interested in her talking because she is very sensitive to these issues. This is something, if the family is interested, we will be happy to talk to you. This is not the government coming and telling you what you should do. And I think the same is true with treatment programs. You are not going to get anywhere unless people trust you and feel like you're listening to them. So I'm not suggesting that Big Brother start taking over the management of our children.
One of the big support groups is clergy and laity concerned. There are a lot of clergymen who are interested in doing programs.
Shame on them for not doing it before.
Well, I mean, I don't know who them are, but I mean, we have a situation in society that we have to address. And, you know, it's there and it's costing us money. There is a huge cost shift going on. And if we don't do the treatment, at least make it available for people, then we're going to pay more later on. And so it's a matter of, I think, dollars and cents. You know, we have to, if for no other reason than to save precious tax dollars, is to put money in the front end instead of the back end. $50,000 a year, $58,000 to incarcerate someone in prison for a year, and we're still building them. In fact, there's an initiative going around now to do Measure 11 for property crimes, for meth property crime, so we're going to do Measure 11 for that, which will be another big prison thing. And I'm not arguing that we shouldn't do the punishment, but I hope we fund the drug courts adequately, because that's been an area that we've been lacking. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think that people have a false impression that people who use drugs are from very poor families, they've been mistreated, and all this. Drug use is across the economic level. They come from all walks of life, all kinds of families, good families, bad families. So I think that that's a bad impression, and I think we should look to Britney Spears. Britney Spears was born and raised 16 miles from my hometown. I know her family, and she came from a rural part of Louisiana. She has a wonderful family support and environment, but she went on to a different part of the world and was very successful financially, but it didn't prevent her from going into the drug scene. So I think that we have to realize kind of what we're dealing with. And when you talk about junior high or this middle school, middle schools are mean. the students in middle schools are mean. They're mean to each other. So people put their children in Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, and do all these things, but the child suffers from low self-esteem. And that is the bottom line. I mean, you can send children to every kind of thing in the world, but if they don't feel good about who they are, then they've got a problem. And that can lead to doing other things to fit in, to be popular. And they can have a good family but want to be popular. So I agree with Senator George in that we have a lot of things wrong in our culture. There's no question about it. And I'm glad in a way that my family are grown and my grandchildren are up as big as they are. But I can tell you that unless we can put 90-day treatment centers in Oregon in every county, that we can really make a dent in what is happening in Oregon. We cannot just have one or two places. It isn't going to work. But if we can have treatment in residential treatment centers in every county where people can go for outpatient, and the residential treatment be at least 90 days long, we could make a huge impact in the state of Oregon in drug use.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to follow up, because I think one of you said that we had a 60% recovery rate?
Completion rate. Yeah, and that's in your green handout.
The green handout.
Compared
okay.
to the national average.
So that's completion. And it sometimes takes several treatments before you actually recover.
Right. And research by SAMHSA has shown that there's a cost benefit all the way up through three times through treatment. Mm-hmm. When people go to treatment three times, that there's still a cost-benefit ratio that occurs. Once it goes over three times, then it starts costing the taxpayer over three times.
And what a joy, follow-up, what a joy it is for those who have actually succeeded in recovery. And we know many, I'm sure all of us know people who have actually succeeded in recovery due to the treatment, and that's where I think our money needs to be put. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to close the information hearing. Jim Davis, are you in the room somewhere? Would you come up, please? We have a request. I'll just wait.
Can we do the LCs now? Or?
Yeah, we're going to do the LCs. Would you get the lights, please? Okay, introduce yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Jim Davis, and representing the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, and Save Oregon Seniors.
Okay, would you tell us why you're here?
Yes. We would like to be able to introduce three of our relatively important bills that affect seniors and disability community. We would like to be able to introduce them as committee bills. One of the bills is LC Draft 3003. This is a bill where we're looking at the service priority level process within senior and disability services and incorporating an ability for seniors and people with disabilities to appeal if they're denied services, and just provides them with a process to be able to do that. We have another LC draft that deals with the development of mental health and addiction services for seniors and persons with disabilities. Right now, they are the population that is most ignored within the system, yet have the highest rates of depression and anxiety and other problems. And so it's really just an appropriations vehicle. We're going to be working with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services and trying to develop more senior and disability services. And so this could be one of the vehicles that we might use. And then finally, in LC Draft 3312, We have put forth a statement that has unanimous support within a senior and disability community, and this really is based upon a concern that the Department of Human Services and seniors and people with disabilities are developing projects around managed health care and the privatization of our long-term care, community-based long-term care system. And it has raised very grave concerns within the senior and disability community. And we are entirely opposed to the concept of managed health care, privatization of services within the long-term care system. And this has come up within the long-term care, the work group on the future of long-term care. And we have shown absolute opposition, but the seniors and people with disabilities division will not back down on this pilot project. And so what we have implemented is language here that would just simply ask that any proposal around the privatization of our national model community-based long-term care system be put before the Legislative Assembly and receive approval within that process before it be implemented. Those are the three pieces, and we would just simply like to make those into committee bills, please.
Let's talk about LC 3312, the one that you just described. So this one doesn't want the department to make that decision. They want it to be a legislative decision if we're going to do it, right?
Yes, okay. That's it, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That is simply all we're asking. We're not at this point asking for any kind of statement of opposition or support so much as what we're saying is that before anything like this happens, it should be brought before the Legislative Assembly because it's a major change that is greatly a matter of concern on the part of both advocates, consumers, and providers within senior and disability communities.
Okay. Any questions about that one?
Mr. Chair, we don't have bills in front of us. All we've got is LC drafts.
Well, I guess what we...
Mr. Chair,
let's just...
We have to go on work session before we...
Session. Okay. We can move on and then they become bills.
Committee bills.
So.
Yeah, okay. Okay, thank you. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on LC 3312.
Mr. Chair... I move LC 3312, LC 2296, and LC 3003 be introduced as committee bills.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves, I may not get them in the same order, LC 2296, LC 3312, LC 3003 be introduced as committee bills. Any further discussion? So ordered.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and we will close the work session. Thank you. Okay, we will open a work session on, a public hearing, I'm sorry. 491. We're going to do 491 first. Senator Deckard, are you in the room?
Yes. He is.
Would you please come up?
Chair, while he's coming up, do you think they should take the graphs down?
Yeah,
it's 4 o'clock. Okay.
Oh.
Well, he's got to sign them and drop them to Judy's.
There we go.
It's got our box.
Nice one.
Go ahead. Introduce yourself, please. Okay. Why don't a couple of you just sit behind for Senator Deckard.
Good afternoon, peers, fellow senators. My name is Ryan Deckard, state senator from Washington County, and with me today are a number of constituents who contacted my office. Most importantly, the constituent I just met about 10 minutes ago, a 2.5-year-old named
Ashlyn,
who talked to me about cochlear implants and the incredible advances. And I just learned today that Blue Cross Blue Shield has decided to cover nationwide cochlear implants. So this is a very timely hearing. I'd love to think that the fact that you scheduled this bill, Mr. Chair, precipitated that action. But it's a great day for obviously thousands and thousands of Americans to be included. And with that, I will turn it over to Helen, who has been working on this issue a great deal, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for listening to the testimony of these constituents.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
My name is Helen Leiser, and I'm Ashlyn's mom. Ashlyn has received a cochlear implant almost a year ago in May, right after her second birthday, and since then we've been fighting for her second ear to be implanted, which we were denied as our insurance company said that it was medically unnecessary and experimental, although it's the same exact surgery piece of equipment and device that would be used in the second ear as it is in the first. So some things that I have put together for you today are some reasons why this bill should pass. I obviously am very passionate about my daughter hearing like any other child. And it's beyond just her. It goes to the fact that children who are untreated with hearing impairment are 10 times more likely to be held back in a grade than children with regular hearing. And that obviously speaks to the tune of about $9,000 a year in our state per child per year that they're held back. There was a 1997 census statistics that demonstrates a significant disparity in employment levels and median income levels between individuals with normal hearing and those with speech or hearing impairments. This means a lot more people collecting organ unemployment, disability, and on state welfare and on insurance rolls. There's a 2006 report specifically focusing on untreated unilateral hearing loss that concluded that households where a wage earner had an untreated hearing impairment of a level associated with a single functioning cochlear implant had on average earned $12,000 less than households where the wage earners with similar education and backgrounds had normal hearing levels. So again, this just, although we don't pay state sales tax here, that's a lot of income that our state is not receiving. As parents, my husband and I work very hard to get our daughter caught up communicatively to her peers, which is a lot of great work. We also have been spending a lot of time fighting our insurance company. We've been through an appeals process that we have now exhausted. We have to consider, do we sell our home to pay for her second ear to be implanted? Do we just rack up the credit card bills? Do we risk bankruptcy? These are things that keep us up awake at night, that take time away from us spending time with our daughter that's productive time and needed time for her. We are also fighting time itself. When a child is implanted, there's about a 14-month period of time in which you want to get the second ear implanted because that way the brain can receive that implant so much easier and so much better. And right now we're running, that's one time frame that we're running up against. The second time frame is the brain, for communication to develop in any child, whether they're hearing or hearing impaired, the first 3.5 years are the best, or they're just the prime years to receive that communication so the brain can develop it and form it so they can learn to talk. So again, she's going to be 3 in May. We're running up against time for that also, as are many other children. There is a local Portland family who did sell their home so they can get their daughter's second implant paid for because the insurance company won't pay for it, and she has also exhausted her resources. The brain, we have everything for a reason. The brain receives sound in stereo, which is why we have our two ears. When we plug, I'm sure you've been on an airplane and put some earplugs in your ears, and in your brain, it's very disconcerting for our brains because it's not receiving the sound the way it's supposed to receive it. One of the main concerns for us as parents, but also for the insurance companies and for the state, is her safety is definitely compromised. It's very easy to tell that although she can hear a sound, she can't necessarily localize where that sound is coming from. And as any parent letting their child ride a bicycle outside, that's enough fear. But to let her go outside and play and knowing that She can't hear if a car is coming out of their driveway while she's riding down the sidewalk. It's very frustrating. It's very scary. It's you know, as summer approaches, we get more and more scared about letting her go outside, but of course she has to. What I've also given you is a copy of two hearing tests that Ashlyn has received. The first copy is her hearing test that was taken a year ago, so prior to her cochlear implant. And you can see down at the bottom is where she was tested at. So basically it showed us profound hearing loss. She was not getting any recognizable speech that she could receive to therefore develop any speech. She heard airplanes. She heard the lawnmower, and that those deep, deep tones, and that was it. There was nothing useful that was provided for her with those sounds. Last Thursday, we did another hearing test with the cochlear implant, and as you can see on the second page, she's testing way down at 15 and 20 decibels all across the board, which means the unit works, first of all. She can hear all the sounds that she needs to hear to develop language, to live and grow and live a beautiful, healthy life. And you know, with two hearing ears, hearing at this level, that equates to just a minimal hearing loss. That means she can hear better than my father. Is what that would equate to. She would gain so much more out of it. And just one more thing, and one of the other gals will speak more to this. But in a classroom setting or in a setting where we have all of her friends over to play, it's really difficult for her. Because of the way that the sound is bouncing off the walls, and with two hearing ears, it would just make such a big difference for her. And really, quite honestly, this is a fight that many of us are fighting, that if this bill is passed here in the state of Oregon, we will really set the precedent for the rest of the United States. The Let Them Hear Foundation out of California is taking this to the legislative level, and they will probably win. It'll take us some time, but you will definitely make a huge difference, not just for our family, for my daughter, but for hundreds of families here in the state of Oregon, as well as really the rest of the United States. And I thank you very much for considering this issue. Okay.
Thank you. If you would, both of you step down, please, for just a moment. And if you would stay right there where you are. And John Powell, would you come up, please? Yeah, I want you to sit right there. And John will sit next to you. would you come and sit on the other side of John? Thank you. Would you hold your baby on your lap? Very good. Great photo op.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and I feel more comfortable with my present company than if I was sitting up there, I think. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for arranging this. We will, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as Senator Deckert indicated, Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, the medical policy has changed in recent months to include, when medically necessary, the other ear, as the witness pointed out. And that is one amendment that we would suggest to the committee as being very important, and that is just the addition of the words "and if medically necessary the other ear." There are indications and situations whereby the development, this problem can be caused by a whole host of things, including the lack of development of the ear itself and the inner ear. And in some cases, it would not do any good to implant another device in the other side. But we agree, and in the case of this child here, where it makes sense, and by putting that term in there, the doctor makes that decision. Again, in order for them to practice medicine and you not to, we think it's advisable to put that in there. But the medical policies of Regents goes back to studying the science of cochlear implants going back to 1995 through as recent as 2006, as the witness said. And the evidence is now clear that not only in children, but in adults, the ability to hear where sound is coming from And in the case of a child, to grow up with that sensory precision is very, very important in their development. So, again, Mr. Chairman, we would simply ask that the term medically necessary be inserted in the bill.
Question?
Yes. I know it varies probably from hospital to hospital, but what is the average cost of having a cochlear implant?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Melissa Anderson, I'll let the witness who has more experience at this than I do answer.
Here at OHSU, it's a 52.
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Helen Leichter. Here at OHSU, the surgery is $52,000. Fine surgeon.
Okay. And just a follow-up, my sister is deaf, and she's 62 now, though, and she did try a cochlear implant and did not like it at all, and hers probably wouldn't have been medically necessary, but she was born with her medical condition was such that it wouldn't have helped her anyway. So I can see the value of having medically necessary in there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, especially for adults, two usually doesn't give a positive result. For children with brains still developing, it's clearly one thing, but I know several adults who one was all they could handle, and what they were told at that point in time was that your brain's old, it can't adjust, so.
Are you satisfied with that?
With the amendment.
With the amendment.
My concern is who discerns what if it's medically necessary. Our insurance company told us, well, if it's medically necessary, your daughter can have a bilateral. And so we were under the assumption that that would be the case. And it was only after her first surgery then we went ahead to place the date for her second surgery, and they said, oh, well, it's not medically necessary because the first implant is working just fine. And that's my concern, and that's why I've asked for this bill to be written, is, we can't get anybody on the phone who can tell us what makes it medically necessary and what makes it medically unnecessary. Basically, what I can discern from what our medical insurance company said to us is the only reason why it would be medically necessary is if the first implant did not take. So they don't take into consideration all the other points that I presented to you and that will also be presented to you today.
Another question I have is, what about infection rates? I don't know if the insurers have that. I know that there have been, at least my sister tells me, she has many of her friends who have had cochlear implants, and a couple of them had problems with it. Is that common or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Sanderson, I think it is extremely difficult if you're an adult to adjust to that sound pattern, particularly if, and I don't want to cause an emotional outburst based on political preference, but you may recall Rush Limbaugh suddenly lost his hearing. It may have been induced by overuse of pain medication. I understand that is a possibility. But just suddenly your hearing goes. And my understanding is he has had this done. And because of his job and probably the ability to afford technologies that are the finest in terms of a studio and that sort of thing, he's able to interact probably both with voice recognition technology and some hearing. But I think it is difficult for some. And again, I think it's medically indicated that there are certain deformities where it does not work well, and there are others where it works much better. And obviously, I think the younger you are, the more adaptable you are. You don't fight it. You engage it, and that probably makes a big difference.
What I'd like to do then is just we'll bring this back, and you can get the amendment, but we will have a discussion as to whether or not we want to try to go with the original bill or with the amendment, and that will give you an opportunity. And So why don't we go ahead, John, and you can have that drafted, and then we will reschedule for the public hearing and hopefully a work session, too.
Okay. I do, if I may, I'm sorry. Kim Davenport is one of Ashland's audiologists who can actually address some of these questions.
Kim, why don't you come up? Yeah, we're not going to hear the rest of the testimony, but we will hear Kim. Thank you. Kim?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Kimberly Davenport, and I am the audiologist at Tucker Maxson Oral School, and I really appreciate the chance to talk with you today. I can actually answer many of the questions that have been posed. I also have questions about what does medically necessary mean, if it means that the patient can derive the maximum benefit, then I would agree with that, certainly. When children or adults go through the pre-implant evaluation, they have a series of tests done, like a CT scan, MRI, hearing testing, speech testing, all these things to determine whether or not they would be a good candidate for a cochlear implant. Some adults are not good candidates, but there are many factors to take into consideration, like the duration of deafness. Have they worn a hearing aid on that ear? When an ear goes a significant amount of time without stimulation, the nerve dies off. So for those adults that don't do well, it often is because of that's been a factor for many people. For children, obviously, they have the neuroplasticity to allow them to adjust really well in most cases. So and I know specifically at OHSU, they're the second largest cochlear implant center on the West Coast, and they have a very stringent battery of tests. They also have very, very high success rates. I work with many of the children who are implanted at OHSU at our school. So I just wanted to address those points. The Let Them Hear Foundation advocacy program out of California is helping many of our families work toward getting a second implant for their children. And Sherry Bernhaber, the attorney who heads up that foundation, she surveyed cochlear implant centers across the country and found that over 90% of cochlear implant surgeons in the U.S. either have done a bilateral cochlear implant or have recommended one but could not do it because insurance would not approve it. I have two children. Actually, I have three children. One just got her second implant 2 days ago. I have several families who are in the process, some of whom have been fighting for over a year and a half. This is critical speech and language development time that their children are missing out on. And working at a school where we focus on auditory-oral methods of communication, we have to have that time to get them up and running and get them to mainstream into the public school system as quickly as we can. As of July 2006, 88% of the centers that Let Them Hear surveyed had performed at least one bilateral cochlear implant, with several doing more than 50. In the research, this is becoming the standard of care. I attend the Cochlear Implant International Conference every year, and there is all the research says that two are better than one, and we know this. Of course, in cases that where the structures are intact and the appropriate habilitation program is followed afterwards. There are over 3,000 people with bilateral cochlear implants. 1,600 of them are children, so there's a lot of research happening, and I'm very much in support of this measure. And
does the amendment medically necessary?
I think it's important to define what medically necessary means. If it means that they can benefit from it, then I agree.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and maybe what would be most appropriate is to come down and have a presentation at some point on the term medically necessary and let the committee understand how that works. And I think the way the bill is written, whereby it says if you cover cochlear in one ear, that you will provide the other, and I think the term medically necessary simply keeps an outlier provider or somebody who does not have the stringent guidelines and practices in place from putting people through this if it's not going to work. It's not only the $50,000, but it's like any invasive medical treatment. If you do that to a person and it's not wise to do it, it shouldn't be done.
Okay.
And that's the point we're trying to make. It's not that we would use that as a technicality to get out of this.
Okay. Now, and you're speaking of anyone who needs the implant, children or adults. You're just talking medically necessary in general for those who are seeking it. Now, and what I'm hearing you say is that the chances, the opportunity is a fleeting opportunity for a child, and the chances of success are much greater, you know, and so the medically necessary would not be as applicable in many ways, but there's always that chance. Now, would this be done at OHSU?
Almost all of our family in Oregon. There's only OHSU is the only center in Oregon that performs.
Now, has the child children. Been diagnosed? Well, of course she has, but I mean, is there any indication that it wouldn't be medically necessary? I mean, that's kind of a vague term.
That term has actually been a difficult thing for my families because they. They haven't taken medically necessary. That what our understanding of medically necessary has been is that they need it to survive or to function. I'm sorry.
I understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in one sense, medically necessary would be a survival necessity. In another case, it would be a normality necessity.
Right. So, I mean, I would say definitely if all the candidacy criteria are taken into consideration and followed stringently, then they're able to tell absolutely who is the best candidates.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to stop right here, and we will come back and we will take a look at this from both sides and see if we can't, you know, move this the next time we have a hearing. But we will.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I can't say enough about Tucker Maxson Oral School. And it's a wonderful school. My sister attended it, and she was one of the first five families that started the school. Mrs. Maxson was actually her teacher for a while. And so I just can't say how much that school does for the teaching of deaf and hearing impaired children. And I didn't remember, but my mother always said her first word was mother. And you know how that is when your daughter hasn't said any words, and she started attending school when she was 3. So she was beyond that age where hearing is. So anyway.
Thank you so much. I'm familiar with your family history, and we're so happy that your family was one of the family's instrumental in the creation of our school.
The great school.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks. And we will close the public hearing. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 357. And we're just going to have a chance to really kind of set the stage. And I'm sorry that some of you will have to come back. You won't have to come back, but I'm sure you will. Okay, I'm going to try to do a balanced hearing in the time we have remaining, and I guess what I would do is call Vern Sable up and have him. Vern, are you here somewhere?
It's on the back row, Mr. McNair.
Yeah. You're up, Bert. We're not going to have time to go through the whole public hearing today. And so what I want to do is get some opening statements and kind of set the stage. So did you want to have someone else with you? Vern, or do you...
Yes, I'd like to have Dr. Dave Peterson and Dr. Gary Schultz come up and join me if they would.
Okay, and then we'll... go ahead. And then we'll take some people from the other side. Very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vern Sabo, representing the Chiropractic Association of Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 357, the rationale of which is relative to public safety. The chiropractic profession has received numerous consumer complaints relative to the failure to make timely referrals for appropriate testing or referral to appropriate medical subspecialties when clinically indicated by some non-physician health care providers. We also have received complaints of injury, both mild and serious, secondary to untrained individuals attempting to perform chiropractic spinal manipulation or spinal adjustments. And I'll give you a very quick caveat of my own. I treat one of the athletes at Oregon State University. Two of her co-athletes on a golf team recount the story of apparently a trainer who believes he has a training to perform cervical, spine, or neck manipulations. And again, those two individuals are not patients of mine. I'm conveying what she observed and what the two fellow golfers indicated, that in fact they were hurt, not seriously, of course, but our concern is that in fact there can be serious complications, especially with high velocity thrusting maneuvers to the cervical spine or neck. It is our notion that healthcare providers wishing to provide chiropractic spinal manipulations or adjustments must possess the diagnostic skill to first recognize when not to perform the procedure. And what I mean by that is there is a myriad of life-threatening conditions that can masquerade as simple back pain, neck pain, or headache, and can be missed by the untrained eye. So individuals performing this service must also have diagnostic skill sets, specifically differential diagnostic skill sets. So in closing, with the public safety in mind, this proposed legislation would also require healthcare providers wishing to provide chiropractic spinal manipulations or adjustments to have completed certain minimum training requirements, which are outlined in the bill. The rationale for this mandatory minimum training is to ensure those wishing to perform this procedure can do so safely and effectively. We are going to have amendments to the bill, and we'll bring those back to the committee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that completes my testimony. I'd be more willing to answer any questions if you have them.
Yes, I have a question. Have you taken this to the Board of Chiropractors, and are they usually the board comes up with the number of hours in that?
Senator Mona Sanderson, you're asking where do the numbers come from?
Well, I'm wondering if the Board of Chiropractors, is that what they're called?
Board of Chiropractic Examiners.
Yeah, Board of Chiropractic Examiners. If they have taken a look at these numbers, what have they said?
Well, the Board of Examiners are made up of my peers. Our executive director has looked at the numbers. From the board members that I've spoken to, they seem to be in agreement. Where those numbers came from was a collaborative effort with the officials at Western States Chiropractic College and other schools around the country, and is also a topic of discussion at the Congress of State Chiropractic Associations as well. So it's kind of a consensus of several folks around the country and here in the state that came up with those numbers.
Senator George.
Vern, could you provide us with a numerous, quoting, received numerous consumer complaints about failure to make timely referral and also about injury both mild and serious?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I can research the specific docs who made those complaints and get more information and give you specifics. And if we can get a release from the patients, I can give you more specifics. I can speak to the medical literature. One of the more serious complaint outcomes that we've seen with some of the more forceful cervical manipulations, or the type of manipulation that predisposes the public to a serious outcome, is specifically vertebral artery dissections. And we know that there is a sub set population, albeit very small, that have what are known as pre-existing arteriopathies. They have weakened vessels. And the more forceful the cervical manipulative procedure, the least specific, the more rotation, extension, the more rough the maneuver, the more likely you're going to end up with a cervical dissection and possible stroke. But I could research and get back to you those specifics. I gave you my example, but I could come back and get more.
Okay, I would appreciate that because the word that was used was numerous.
Okay. Thanks. Good. Thank you. Who would like to go next?
I'll go next. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for letting me testify. I'm sure you can discern that I'm also here to testify in support of Senate Bill 357.
Introduce yourself.
I'm David Peterson. I'm a professor of chiropractic science at Western States Chiropractic College. I've been involved in chiropractic education for about 27 years. During that time, I've taught spinal biomechanics, manual examination and manipulation of the spine. I have participated in clinical research of chiropractic diagnostic and manipulative techniques. I presented at numerous postgraduate lectures and published a number of articles and co-authored some reference texts on chiropractic manipulation for the profession. So I'm going to focus my testimony in support of the bill based on my experience and expertise concerning extensive training and skills that are necessary to competently and effectively deliver thrust manipulative procedures. So in that context, manipulation of the spine and extremity joints is a competency that demands excessive training. It demands a lot of supervised practice and integrated clinical instruction to achieve proficiency and competency. Like many other complex medical procedures or refined physical skills, it cannot be mastered in limited hours of training or weekend postgraduate seminars. In addition to extensive hours of instruction, it is critical that the student of manipulative procedures also fulfill a prescribed and directed clinical experience, comprising a sufficient period of time during which specific knowledge, attitudes, and skills can be developed through repeated cycles of instruction and practice with expert feedback. This type of instruction must be taught by instructors who have significant experience in this field, in both applying the techniques clinically and practice and teaching. And I'm specifically referring not only to general manipulative procedures, but specific thrust manipulative procedures. And these teaching environments must be practical, with low student to instructor ratios, with direct one-on-one observation and feedback. Expertise in hands-on manual therapy, other manual therapies such as massage, joint mobilization, and muscle stretching, do not automatically transfer to having the necessary skills to be able to provide thrust manipulation. Although this may modestly decrease the learning curve in this capacity, additional extensive hours are typically needed to master the skills of thrust manipulation. At Western States Chiropractic College, the Doctor of Chiropractic degree program includes 600 lecture and lab hours devoted to manual examination and adjustive treatment of the spine. 490 of those hours are devoted to practical hands-on laboratory instruction. In each of those courses, we maintain a ratio of about 7 students to each licensed DC instructor in the course. I would say that this program is pretty commensurate with other chiropractic degree programs in the country. And WSC's educational course in clinical training in manipulative therapy begins very early in the program. It starts in the first quarter and continues all the way through the 12 quarters of instruction. And the students apply these skills and their expertise in the clinics, inpatient and outpatient clinics. So in conclusion, I think Senate Bill 357 outlines adequate requirements to ensure safe and effective delivery of joint thrust manipulation procedures. Thank you. Any questions?
Senator George.
I have a letter here, an email that says physical therapists are educated, qualified, and competent to provide spinal manipulation.
Well, I think the first thing you've got to ask yourself is, what is the level of education you're talking about? I know that physical therapists have both master's and doctoral degrees in manipulative therapies, and in some cases they have more instruction depending on how far their education goes. But I think in general, relative to thrust manipulative techniques, it's pretty minimal compared to chiropractic education, and so their competence, in my opinion, is significantly deficient relative to chiropractic in this particular area.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to, Senator George, I'm looking at a chart that was put together by two students at Western States Chiropractic College. You do not have this in front of you, and I'll get it to you. One is a master's in physical therapy, and it's a side-by-side core curriculum comparison between the Doctor of Chiropractic Medicine versus the Master's of Physical Therapy and the Doctor of Physical Therapy. And the physical therapist can correct me on this if it's inaccurate. According to the core curriculum of the Doctor of Physical Therapy, under musculoskeletal exam and intervention for the neck and trunk, the total number of hours are 45. I spoke with a professor at the school, and he indicated that, in fact, they are learning high-velocity, low-amplitude thrusting procedures. There are also musculoskeletal exam and intervention of the extremities, which is 60 hours, an adult neuromusculoskeletal examination intervention 1 and 2, which is 90 hours. It's unclear within those hours, which are considerably less than at the chiropractic school, how much of that is devoted to spinal palpation and high-velocity thrusting procedures. I might add that the total number of hours at the Pacific University School of Physical Therapy, according to this chart, this work product from these students is 20, and this includes the 1,400 hours in clinical studies, is 2,730 hours versus the 4,896 hours at the chiropractic school. And again, many of the deficiencies that we see on this chart relative to the two educational core curriculums are in the realm of physical diagnosis, lab diagnosis, differential diagnosis, x-ray diagnosis, clinical and general pathology.
Follow-up question.
Yes.
Another statement made here is that, and this is a doctor chiropractic here, says that there is no evidence that physical therapists utilizing manipulation procedures produce a greater risk to the public health.
That's
kind of no evidence is what they claim.
I think the problem with that statement is that there hasn't been any really evidence comparing chiropractic manipulative therapy, high-velocity manipulative therapy, to physical therapists doing the same procedures. So that doesn't mean that they are less qualified or less effective. We're making the point that they have significant less training. We have a public safety and concern issue. It's just recently that physical therapists have started to become more interested in applying chiropractic high-velocity procedures because of the growing efficacy, clinical efficacy of the effects of their therapy. So that statement really in many ways doesn't make any sense. There's no way to, at this point, refute it because the research hasn't been done.
But you can see why I asked the question about numerous consumer complaints, because if they were legally able to practice that today, then the question is there a problem here?
I think that's a different question. The one question is asking, can physical therapists use high-velocity manipulation and get as good a clinical outcome and clinical effect? That's not asking about the potential risks of applying the therapy.
Mr. Chair,
Can I? No, wait a minute.
Sure.
We're going to have to be out of, physically, we have to be out of this room by 5 o'clock. And we started with 15 minutes for each, and you're almost out of your 15 minutes. And we're going to have three other people come up. So we're running out of time. So, and then we're going to come back again, and we will finish the discussion. But given the fact that we have the time constraint, if we didn't have to be out of this room, we could stay and finish the discussion, but we can't. So, did you want to say something briefly, Vern?
Well, I wasn't sure if we could not get Dr. Schultz's testimony at least out of the way today.
Well, if you can do it fairly quickly.
Thank you, Vern, please.
Yeah.
I will make every attempt to respect the committee's time. My name is Gary Schultz. I'm the Vice President for Academic Affairs at Western States Chiropractic College, and I'm going to limit my comments specifically to the area of diagnosis and differential diagnosis. I believe this is an area that really represents where the rubber hits the road. In determining whether manipulation, and by manipulation I mean thrust manipulation, high velocity, low amplitude thrusting, is appropriate, it is absolutely essential that an appropriate diagnosis be established, which would include ruling out those conditions which would preclude the adjustive thrust or modify it substantially. At Western States Chiropractic College, every student is exposed to over 1,200 hours of diagnosis, which is not specifically limited to the neuromusculoskeletal system. It also includes the other systems of the body, the cardiorespiratory, the genitourinary, the gastrointestinal, the obviously the neuromusculoskeletal system, but also the skin and special populations, pediatrics and geriatrics. So there are a variety of areas of didactic and clinical instruction which occur, which are far more comprehensive than just the neuromusculoskeletal system, which is the primary area of effect of manipulative thrusts. So it is imperative that anyone who endeavors to provide this type of therapy be capable of evaluating those other areas of the body in order to ensure that significant conditions don't exist in those areas which would preclude a manipulative thrust. And I'll conclude by simply stating that chiropractors provide about 95% of the thrust manipulation that is delivered in the United States. And I believe that our 100-plus years of providing this type of therapy puts us in a unique position to assist the committee and others in understanding what the minimum requirements should be before safely and effectively applying this type of procedure. And I'll conclude there. Okay. Questions?
Did you have a question? Oh, question?
Well, I guess that my question is, what are you worried about? What is it that you don't want physical therapists to be able to do it? Are you worried about me if I need that particular procedure done, that I might go to the wrong place?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, members of the committee, we're worried about injury to patients, and this is not specific to physical therapists. We're talking about athletic trainers. We're talking about massage therapists. We're talking about other lay individuals, non-physician types, who are attempting to perform spinal manipulation, and consumers are being hurt, both mild and serious types of injuries. The great majority of them are mild, but the minority of the, which are the major complications, serious injuries, should be of great concern as well. This isn't specific to just physical therapists manipulating.
And if I could comment, Gary Schultz, once again for the record, very briefly, there has been a small amount of research done evaluating serious complications to manipulation, specifically vertebral basilar arterial insult. And in looking at that literature going back almost 100 years, a substantial percentage of those injured by manipulative thrust with that specific injury were injured by non-physician practitioners. So in other words, they were injured by individuals who attempted to perform this procedure without appropriate training, or at least without training commensurate with that received in chiropractic colleges. So I think there is a basis for concern.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So are all three of you seeing a certain number of people that are coming to you after they've been injured by non-physician manipulation and telling you that they've had the stun, now they're injured and they're coming to your office so you can fix them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, no, this is a number of my colleagues. We communicate at seminars, symposiums, and on our statewide listserv and our national listserv. We're not referring to just our patients. We're referring to what we're being told by our colleagues in the field. And we're not just talking about this year. We're talking over a number of years where, in fact, we will hear an instance where there was this or that lay individual, non-physician, who attempted to manipulate or provide a chiropractic adjustment, and the patient was hurt. So this is, we're not talking about just our patients.
Okay. Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Tracy Rutten, Bob Mee, and Richard Rutt. Now, what did you say? Did you tell me that I continued until it's over, right? Yeah. Now we're having the other time.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name for the record is Tracy Rutten. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. And as we have with us today, many individuals who have taken time out of their practice and rescheduled appointments. We're going to try and let them go first, so I'm going to be extremely brief.
We're going to be out of here by 5 o'clock.
That's why I'm going to be about 30 seconds.
Okay.
They're much more important than I am. I just want to state that Oregon Physical Therapy Association is in opposition to this bill, and I've submitted my written testimony to you in the case that you have the time. I know you don't have a lot of it these days to read over it. I would just like to address the previous testimony, which stated that patient risk, that there's been no real data or measure of the patient risk, and I would counter that by saying that we do have our own Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board, which deals with claims and deals with patient risk issues and patient consumer safety issues. We also have liability insurance, and there's a letter attached to my testimony that I think will also show that there's no increase in liability that has been found by the providers of this insurance. But with that, I will just say that we're in opposition to the bill. I'd be happy to answer questions and come back again at a later date, but I will turn it over to these two gentlemen.
My name is Richard Rutt. I'm the director of the School of Physical Therapy at Pacific University, and I again thank the chair and the committee members for allowing us to comment and to state our opposition to this bill. We do not instruct our students in chiropractic manipulative therapy. We do use, however, a technique that has been long part of physical therapy practice, and that is high velocity, low amplitude thrust. And this is part of our education and has been for many years and is required by the Commission on Accreditation in Physical Therapy Education, and also is part of the normative model of physical therapy education, the 2004 version. We recently have undergone a reaccreditation process where the commission performed a very in-depth view or review of our program, and including what we have included in our program related to high velocity, low amplitude thrust techniques, and found that we were in compliance with the commission and the requirements for the application of those particular techniques. So again, I would like to just briefly and be able to turn it over to Bob Nee, who is actually the instructor in this area of our curriculum, to provide data. But we do not instruct in chiropractic adjustments.
So thank you, members of the committee. I'm Bob Nee. I'm an assistant professor at the School of Physical Therapy. I've been a licensed physical therapist since 1986. And I also went through a year's worth of specialty training in manual therapy at the University of South Australia. To differentiate my written testimony from Dr. Rutt's, mine has a little footer in the bottom right-hand corner, starting with my last name, Nee, to help differentiate. I would echo the things that Dr. Rutt has mentioned related to the fact that we're not advocating that we're teaching chiropractic adjustments, but we are doing high-velocity, low-amplitude thrust, and I think it's important to distinguish to Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee that those two terms are not synonymous. I'd like to focus on, in terms of the content area that we address, one of the things that we focus on within our curriculum is teaching our students how to recognize when it's most appropriate to utilize high-velocity thrust techniques to make sure that it is safe and that it is appropriate for that particular patient's disorder. And I can offer some data in my written testimony related to what the members of the Chiropractic Association discussed in terms of adverse events related to thrust techniques and vascular events. Physical therapists, in a literature review that was published in 1999, are involved in less than 2% of those adverse events to which they referred in that particular data. In terms of with my written testimony, they've also mentioned a lot related to hours of training. I think it would be important to emphasize that I'm not aware of any data that points to a certain minimum number of hours that specifically guarantees safety or quality in utilizing low-amplitude thrust techniques for treatment of patients for any kind of spinal condition. In terms of the content that we utilize, the data that we use to help identify patients most likely to respond is based on asking them questions such as, what is the location of their symptoms? How are their symptoms affected by movement? Do they have any issues of fear related to movement? And then performing a variety of physical examination tests related to body posture or mobility that's based on research done by physical therapists that shows that this combination of data is going to identify accurately people that are going to respond well to manipulation and receive it in a safe fashion. It does not require the ability to identify a specific pathological diagnosis, but it does require that we identify those people that do or don't have an orthopedic sort of problem. And that differentiation between someone who has an orthopedic problem and recognizing that, and recognizing someone who has a potentially non-orthopedic problem, where within our scope of practice we should refer that on, that's part of what our training is as physical therapists as well. And I think that in the interest of time, that I would leave it at that point there and open it up to the committee for questions.
Yes, Senator George.
Could you describe the process of high velocity low amplitude manipulation? What does that look like?
Do it on him.
There can be any number of techniques. Basically, it involves placing the patient in a position where it can be potentially more targeted or less targeted to a specific region of the spine. It may or may not involve putting them at the end range of position, and then it involves applying a fast movement that's a short amplitude movement that to impart the physiological effect of the technique. So you could equate it to cracking your knuckles.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Sorry, my apologies.
All right, aren't the bulk of your referrals from MDs? Every time I've been to a therapist, they sent me through a medical doctor who said, you probably ought to go try this.
The bulk of our referrals are from physicians, but also in the state of Oregon, we do have the ability to practice as a direct access practitioner for up to 30 days. And part of our role, regardless of whether we get someone from referred from a physician or whether it's direct access, is to differentiate, is it an orthopedic problem appropriate for us to treat, or is it something that requires further consultation with another medical professional?
I may have misunderstood if I could do a follow-up. I may have understood what was said, but you don't know of any masseuse who's doing this kind of practice.
I don't have any personal ability to state what other professions are doing. I'm just here to state what's within the scope of practice with as physical therapists and how this matches our scope of practice and how we can apply it in a safe and effective manner.
And this is allowed practice today?
Pardon?
This is allowed practice today.
For a physical therapist, yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay.
Senator Berger.
Well, I think he's answered my question. My question was going to be, do you have concerns that there are people that are unqualified, that are injuring people by trying to do some of the things that you do professionally?
That's a loaded question.
That's all right. That's all right. No comments, just fine.
Now, the liability laws are always in play, right?
Yes.
So if someone is injured and they hire a lawyer and they look into the type of technique and practice and so on, then that eventually would determine the liability, I imagine, at some point. Point. I mean, that would be argued, but have these cases come up? Have you had experience, or are you aware of cases where people have brought a suit, filed a suit?
Mr. Chair, I personally am not aware of the number. I imagine somewhere in the United States that a suit may have been brought, but I am not aware of suits brought against physical therapists. I don't have personal awareness of that.
Other questions? Okay. Well, I very much apologize. We were planning to get started much earlier, but there were some things that came up, and we did have to include them. But we will continue this on Wednesday. We will continue this discussion. We do have a work session on the bill. And what else? Oh, there's another. We do have a...
We have a work session on 34 and 407.
Okay. So with that, I will go ahead and close the public hearing.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.